time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting at least 19 are known to have died and dozens more were wounded in a blast late Monday at an Ariana Grande concert in the English city of Manchester. Chief Constable Ian Hopkins said the blast is being treated as a terrorist incident.
This is clearly a very concerning time for everyone. We're doing all that we can, working with local and national agencies to support those affected as we gather information about what happened last night.
If confirmed, the blast would be the worst terrorist incident in the United Kingdom in a dozen years. President Donald Trump meets Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas Tuesday in the West Bank town of Bethlehem. Mr. Trump hopes to kickstart the moribund Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Monday, he met Israeli officials, reaffirming what he called the enduring friendship between the U.S. and Israel.
This moment in history calls for us to strengthen our cooperation as both Israel and America face common threats from ISIS and other terrorist groups to countries like Iran that sponsor terrorism and fund and foment terrible violence, not only here, but all over the world.
Mr. Trump, who addressed leaders of the Gulf Cooperation Council in Riyadh Sunday, said they agreed that Iran must not be allowed to possess nuclear weapons. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu applauded the change in U.S. policy.
I want you to know how much we appreciate the change in American policy on Iran. I want you to know how much we appreciate your bold decision to act against the use of chemical weapons in Syria. And I want to tell you also how much we appreciate the reassertion of American leadership in the Middle East.
And he welcomed Mr. Trump's visit to the Western Wall, one of Judaism's holiest shrines, the first sitting president to do so. This is VOA News. U.S. forces killed seven members of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula early Tuesday in a raid in central Yemen. U.S. Central Command said its forces, with Yemeni government backing, used small arms fire and precision airstrikes to attack a terrorist compound in Marib Governorate. The U.N. Security Council will take up the matter of North Korea's banned nuclear missile programs Tuesday when it considers tough new sanctions. Monday, the Council unanimously expressed its concern over Pyongyang's highly destabilizing behavior and flagrant and provocative defiance of previous resolutions. The North Sunday conducted its latest intermediate-range ballistic missile test. Tufts University Korea analyst Sung-Yoon Lee said he's unimpressed by such past UN statements.
The fallout from such condemnation by the international community, in my view, does not compare to the strategic advantage gained by North Korea from continued provocations, weapons tests, and its enhanced capability.
Pyongyang Sunday said its test met all technical requirements and the missile could now be deployed. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has called the latest test both disappointing and disturbing. Former South Korean President Park Geun-hye has gone on trial on bribery charges that forced her impeachment and removal from office. She faces more than 10 years in jail if found guilty of taking bribes from business leaders. Ms. Park has denied any wrongdoing and was expected to enter a not guilty plea. The U.S. Senate Monday confirmed former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad as the next ambassador to China. Oklahoma Senator James Lankford presided.
On this vote, the yeas are 82, the nays are 13. The nomination is confirmed. Under the previous order, the motion to reconsider is considered made and laid upon the table. The president will be immediately notified of the Senate's action.
Branstad, during his confirmation hearings, assured lawmakers he would take a strong stand with Beijing on the issue of North Korea, as well as trade matters and human rights. Gambia's government seized the assets of exiled former President Yahya Jammeh. They include nearly 90 bank accounts and multiple properties and companies. Jammeh accused of stealing millions in public funds before fleeing Gambia for Equatorial Guinea in January. In her final address as head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Margaret Chan insisted the agency is relevant despite its slow response to the Ebola epidemic in West Africa.
This was West Africa's first experience with Ebola, and the outbreak took everyone, including WHO, by surprise.
While insisting the WHO made quick course corrections, she said she holds herself personally accountable for the agency's early failures during the 2014 outbreak that killed more than 11,300 people. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Gambian authorities say former dictator Yahya Jammeh stole $50 million from the state-run telecom company and that his assets in the country have been frozen.
We have today obtained a court order freezing or placing a temporary hold on the known assets in the country of former President Yahya Jammeh and companies or organizations directly associated with him.
Abubakar Tambadou is Gambia's justice minister. South Sudan president has sworn in the steering committee members of the long-awaited national dialogue process. And East African community leaders demand the European Union lifts sanctions on Burundi.
Burundi is our member and we want them to sign after we have harmonized. But how will they sign when they are under sanction without a discussion? So please, our house is our house. Don't come into my house without consultation.
That's Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, chair of the East African Community. Burundi's government welcomes East African Community call for an end to EU sanctions, and the outgoing head of the World Health Organization says the body remains relevant. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Gambian authorities say former President Yahya Jammeh stole $50 million from the state-run telecom company and that his assets in the country have been frozen. Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadou says the court order affects 88 different bank accounts in Jammeh's name or those of his associates, along with 14 companies linked with the former strongman. Sini Marina reports from Banjul.
At a news conference on Monday in the capital, Banjul, Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadou told journalists that the former President Yahya Jammeh assets have been frozen and investigations are not conclusive as efforts are underway to unearth the truth behind Jammeh's illegal.
We have today obtained a court order freezing or placing a temporary hold on the known assets in the country of former President Yahya Jammeh and companies or organizations directly associated with him. The freezing order affects 131 landed properties held in the personal name of former President Yahya Jammeh or companies or organizations directly associated with him, 86 different bank accounts held in the personal name of former President Yahya Jammeh or held in the names of companies or organizations directly associated with him. 14 companies purportedly belonging to or directly associated with former President Yahya Jammeh, and a number of animals and livestock purportedly belonging to former President Yahya Jammeh.
On the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the Justice Minister said a draft bill is at the final stage and the commission will soon be operational.
On the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, we have successfully conducted a study tour of the transitional justice processes in Sierra Leone with special interest on their version of a truth and reconciliation. Following the completion of the study tour and after careful consideration based on a number of factors, including recommendations made by the study tour team, we now wish to establish in the Gambia a Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission, whose principal objectives will be to give the victims of abuses a voice by allowing them to share their stories with the Gambian people, to give the perpetrators the opportunity to tell the whole truth about these abuses in a manner that normal criminal proceedings will not permit, and to give appropriate compensation to the victims for loss or injury suffered as a result of the abuses.
Meanwhile, prosecutors in Banjul also issue an arrest warrant for two Gambian soldiers named in the killing of prominent Gambian journalist Dede Haidra. Major Sana Manjang and Colonel Kausu Kamara were part of Gambia's former dictator Yahya Jammeh's paramilitary hit squad, known as the Junglers, implicated in human rights violations, including arbitrary detention, killing, enforced disappearance, and torture. Ezra, a journalist critical of Jammeh regime, was assassinated in December 2004 by Jammeh special forces. Jammeh refused to open an independent investigation into his death, choosing to blame the newspaper publisher of causing his own death by attacking people. The arrest warrant is regarded as first sign of victory towards securing justice. Meanwhile, authorities have also released names of 8 military officers for the 2013 killing of an ex-army chief, Colonel Nduru Cham. Gambia's police, who are leading investigation into 10 of killings by the loyalists of the former President Jammeh, said Cham was captured in the northern Gambia and killed shortly on the orders of Mr. Jammeh. Aisha Jammeh is the daughter of Haruna Jammeh. Former President Jammeh's brother alleged to have been assassinated on the orders of the former president. Aisha was a teenager when his dad was killed.
Look, what I remember about my dad was somebody so truthful. He was a man of honor, and then he doesn't want anything from, he doesn't involve in things that doesn't concern him. He was somebody truthful. He was somebody who loved his kids. He was somebody who will die for his children. He will do anything to make his kids and his family happy. That was how my dad. Yes, I miss my dad because when it was happening, I was just 12 years old. And then it has really been the most terrible moments of our lives, us living without my dad, without seeing a grave of him, without seeing his dead body or anything.
Reporting for VOA News in Banjul, I am Sini M.K. Marena.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, who is current chair of the East African Community, has called on the European Union to lift sanctions on Burundi as a condition for the community to sign a trade partnership with the EU. Mr. Museveni made the call at the just-concluded summit of East African heads of state in the Tanzanian capital, Dar es Salaam. Moses Aviarimana reports from Bujumbura.
During the 18th Ordinary Summit of the Heads of State of the East African Community, the Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni blamed the European sanctions as a major obstacle to sign the Economic Partnership Agreement with the East African Community. Negotiations between the East African Community and the European Union have been ongoing for almost a decade.
Burundi has had problems in the past, and even now they still have some issues. But this is our problem. We are the ones who can solve it. Therefore, with the European Union, we have the problem of you unilaterally saying that you put sanctions on Burundi. This is our member.
The European Union suspended direct aid to the Burundi government since 2015, when President Pierre Nkurunziza vied for a controversial third term. President Yoweri Museveni says that the international community should first consult with the regional blocs before imposing sanctions.
Recently, there was talk about South Sudan, that they wanted to put sanctions on South Sudan in the UN. But you, what sort of bad manners is this? So please, Burundi, this is our member, and we want them to sign after we have harmonized. We want them to sign EPA, but how will they sign when they are under sanctions without a discussion? So please, our house is our house. Don't come into my house without consultation, if you are really my good friend.
Currently, Europe is East Africa's largest export destination, but in terms of imports, the European Union ranks third after China and India. The European Union said that the respect of human rights and fight against impunity could give a chance for the aid to resume in Bujumbura. Christian Joly is the chargé d'affaires of European Union in Burundi.
The decisions regarding Burundi have been preceded by long, very detailed, very organized discussions with the government of Burundi. They lasted for months before the EU finally decided to take these appropriate measures. What we find in the 8 points that President Mkapa has put on the table for the discussions is very close to what we are asking under our additional Article 96.
Article 96 provides the legal basis for suspension of the Cotonou Agreement following a period of dialogue in cases where one of the parties feels that agreement's essentials and fundamental elements are not respected. That includes human rights abuses. The United Nations Human Rights documented hundreds of cases of human rights violations in Burundi since 2015, when protests erupted against President Pierre Nkurunziza's third term in the office. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 23rd. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Burundi's government says it welcomes East African community leaders' call for an end to European Union sanctions against Burundi. At their summit in Tanzania's capital, Dar es Salaam, last week, the leaders called for an end to sanctions against Burundi as a precondition for the bloc to consider signing a trade partnership with the EU. The sanctions include a travel ban and asset freeze against Burundians whose activities the EU judged to be undermining democracy or obstructing the search for a political solution to the crisis in Burundi. They are set for reconsideration in October this year. Burundian Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe says the East African community took into consideration the prevailing situation on the ground in Burundi, including the ongoing inter-Burundian dialogue. Nyamitwe says there is no way Burundi can sign a trade deal that is based purely on political considerations.
Well, I think the government of Burundi can only express its pleasure after the summit, because during the summit, our delegation had the opportunity to share with the heads of state and government and leaders of the delegations present the views on the political situation in the country and on the dialogue between and among Burundians. On the other hand, the government has also had the opportunity to state categorically that in the current state of affairs between the European Union and Burundi, there is no way the government of Burundi can sign the Economic Partnership Agreement, which was negotiated between the East African community as a bloc and the European Union.
What do you think, Minister, that your government is doing or has done to encourage, say, the European Union to lift sanctions on your government? What have you done?
Well, let me first of all say, James, that the issue is broad. In fact, in the relations between the European Union and African, Caribbean, and Pacific states, over the years, we've been seeing the inclusion of political considerations into trade affairs. Basically, what is at the heart of the sanctions which were decided against Burundi? The sanctions are based on the Cotonou Agreement, which indeed we have signed as a state, but which was used against Burundi, as it has been used against many other ACP countries, and as is going to be used against many other ACP countries. And so we are involved in a dialogue, and we will continue that dialogue. We have not yet reached a point of agreement, but I am hopeful that at some point in the future, we'll come to a point where we say, all right, the sanctions now are behind, and then we'll be able to talk serious business among ourselves. But prior to that, it will be very difficult for Burundi to enter into that partnership agreement.
Could it be, Mr. Minister, that these sanctions are biting in your country's economy? Because we have reports of fuel shortages and electricity shortages in your country. Are these sanctions having an impact on your economy?
Obviously, I think it's clear that the sanctions have had an impact on our economy, because some of the items were subsidized by the government, were no longer available in the same quantity. Therefore, the sanctions have had an impact in some ways, but not fully.
On the issue of the dialogue, is it still the view of your government that you don't want certain people to participate in this dialogue, or are you more flexible at this time?
Let me put it this way. President Kapa has presented his report, and he has reformulated a number of recommendations. The facilitator, President Kapa, and the mediator, in reference to President Museveni of Uganda, will continue their consultations. We have always said that we believe that dialogue should be reserved for peaceful stakeholders, but position has not yet changed. And I'd love to stop there on that particular matter, because there might be maybe infringing on other people's rights to express themselves on the matter.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir yesterday finally launched the national dialogue process, which he promised last year, by swearing in the steering committee members. Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni was in Juba as chief guest of the event. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from the capital, Juba.
As the co-chairperson, impartial and bear true allegiance to...
That is Acting Chief Justice John Gadwich, leading the members of the steering committee of the National Dialogue Process, taking oath at a swearing-in ceremony at Freedom Hall. President Kiir says the main objective of the National Dialogue is to end all violent conflicts across South Sudan, constitute national consensus, and save the country from what he terms disintegration and foreign interference. The president says the committee's work starts immediately.
I want the committee to conduct consultations as wide as possible to give the people of South Sudan the opportunity to air out their views and aspirations for the restoring peace to their country. The dialogue should start with those who are willing, while the committee continues to engage those who are hesitant or have concerns.
In an effort to gain the trust of the South Sudanese people, Mr. Kiir directed the government's prosecutor general to review all cases of those who have been arrested or are under detention for political reasons so that they can be released. The president also declared a unilateral ceasefire for his army, saying they will only act in self-defense if attacked by opposing armed forces.
And this, of course, has been the call of many people in the international forums that the ceasefire must be declared. So I have now declared unilateral ceasefire so that we can create an environment for an inclusive dialogue and to facilitate the movement of humanitarian assistance to famine-stricken areas.
Mr. Kiir says he also ordered his National Security Service agents to stop harassing civilians and opposition groups across the country. The president says the steering committee should consult with all stakeholders participating in the dialogue, including former First Vice President Riek Machar. He says his government is willing to safeguard any opposing group that wants to send representatives to participate in the process. Ugandan President Museveni flew to Juba to stand by the president's side at the launch of the event. In his 35-minute speech, Museveni urged South Sudanese leaders to avoid tribalism and embrace unity as a critical step in restoring peace and stability across the country.
I salute President Salva Kiir for inviting all these stakeholders here and saying you discuss the problems that have afflicted South Sudan in the recent times.
Several activists have criticized the initiative, saying if rebel groups are not invited to take part in the dialogue, it's a waste of time. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The outgoing Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, has opened this year's World Health Assembly by staunchly defending the organization against critics who say it has lost its relevance. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Margaret Chan will soon step down as head of the World Health Organization. After 10 years of service, she appears intent on handing her successor, who will be elected Tuesday, an organization that is viable and remains the essential leader in global health. In addressing the World Health Assembly in Geneva for the last time, Chan presented the thousands of delegates with what could be seen as a report card of her work. She summarized a report she issued this month, tracking the evolution of public health during her 10-year administration.
The report sets out the facts and assesses the trends, but makes no effort to promote my administration. The report goes some way towards dispelling criticism that WHO has lost its relevance. The facts tell a different story.
Chan says the report covers setbacks as well as successes and some landmark events. Among the successes, she cites WHO's decade-long fight to bring down prices for antiretroviral treatments for HIV. She also notes progress in areas such as the elimination or reduction of neglected tropical diseases, in bringing mental health out of the shadows and into the spotlight, and in bringing polio closer to eradication. But she also accepts responsibility for failures, including WHO's slowness in recognizing the magnitude of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. She acknowledges the devastating consequences of this lapse for the populations of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea.
But WHO made quick course corrections, brought the three outbreaks under control through teamwork and partnerships, and gave the world its first Ebola vaccine that confers substantial protection. This happened on my watch, and I am personally accountable.
Chan urges governments to maintain investments in health development, which she says brings dramatic results and helps reduce poverty.
Thank you.
Judging from the rousing applause at the end of her speech, the delegates appear to have given Margaret Chan an A for her work during the past 10 years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Over the past 2 years, a multinational joint task force has weakened the militant group Boko Haram along the border between Nigeria and Niger and in the islands around Lake Chad. A camp opened last December in Nigeria in the southeastern city of Diffa to de-radicalize Boko Haram fighters and their families who surrendered. VOA correspondent Nicolas Pinot visited the camp during a recent trip to Niger and files this report.
A few kilometers from Diffa, Asaga camp houses hundreds of Nigerian refugees and internally displaced people from Niger, struggling to survive every day. You can easily find malnourished kids living among the wind, sand, and tents. Mamadou is 1 year old, weak, and hungry. His mother, Shatushiwa, is hungry too. With little milk, she cannot provide enough food for her boy.
Since his birth, we have been visiting the health center. When he was 6 months, they started giving him peanut paste. He is always tired and cries to eat, but I do not have enough milk.
According to UNICEF, about 12,000 children under age 5 will suffer malnutrition this year in Diffa. Many will have to be treated at a center of intensive nutritional strengthening run by Mustafa Saleh. This doctor visits his patients every day. Some are only skin and bones, like this 3-year-old boy, who weighs only 5.6 kilograms.
It is too early to know what the odds are for him. He arrived a week ago, very shocked, as you can see. These kids do not eat enough. We need a tube to feed them.
Despite these worrisome scenes, there is no famine in Diffa, nor in Niger as a whole. However, each year, this country in the Sahel region of Africa faces food challenges because of recurring drought and desertification, in addition to the threat posed by Boko Haram. According to the World Food Programme, 1.5 million people currently face food insecurity in Niger, lacking reliable access to a nutritious food supply. Back in Asaga camp, refugees say they have not received any food assistance for the past 4 months. They have nothing to do to earn a living and cannot go back home as the threat of Boko Haram still looms across northeast Nigeria. For now, Faluma Tabuka works as a community relay at the health center.
In the camp, life is difficult. We don't have enough food. Kids are hungry and have diarrhea. We brought them to the health center where they receive high nutrition supplements, but parents can't afford them. Our life back in our village was easier.
The coming lean period before the next harvest will likely bring a hike of malnutrition cases. Doctors here are used to that pattern since the start of the Boko Haram insurgency. Nicolas Pinot, VOA News, Diffa, Niger.
Briefly before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Gambian authorities say former President Yahya Jammeh stole $50 million from the state-run telecom company and that his assets in the country have been frozen. Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadu says the court order affects 88 different bank accounts in Jammeh's name. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.